Good evening. A disappointing jobs report, new videos of a police killing revealed in New York, and a vote to legalize marijuana in Congress, and the future of Governor's Island. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, December 4th, 2020. U.S. employers added a disappointing 245,000 jobs in November amid a surge in COVID-19 cases and more state business constraints, as well as the looming halt of extended jobless benefits and other federal lifelines for millions of Americans. The unemployment rate, which is calculated from a different survey, fell to 6.7 from 6.9%, but that was because the number of people working or looking for jobs fell by 400,000. President-elect Biden had this to say earlier today.
We remain in the midst of one of the worst economic and job crises in modern history. But it doesn't have to stay that way. If we act now, we can begin to regain momentum and start to build back a better future. There's no time to lose. Millions of people have lost their jobs or had their hours slashed. They've lost their health insurance or are in danger of losing their health insurance. One in every six renters is behind in rent. One in four small businesses can't keep their doors open. And there's a growing gap in Black and Latino unemployment, and the gap remains much too large. And it's deeply troubling that last month's drop in overall unemployment was driven by people who were dropping out of the job market, not because more people were being hired. Dropping out of the job market altogether. They've lost hope of finding a job, or they're taking full-time caregiving responsibilities as child centers remain closed and their children learn remotely. Over the past 3 months, 2.3 million more people are long-term unemployed, meaning for 23 weeks or more. By far the largest increase on record. This is a dire jobs report. It's a snapshot, I might remind you, up to mid-November. Before the surge in COVID cases we predicted, many predicted, and the deaths rise that we've seen in December as we head into a very dark winter ahead. If Congress and President Trump fail to act by the end of December, 12 million Americans will lose their unemployment benefits they rely on. Merry Christmas. Unemployment benefits allowing them to keep food on the table, to keep the lights on and the heat on, pay their bills. Emergency paid leave will end. The moratorium on evictions will expire. States will lose the vital tools they need to pay for COVID testing and public health. Put yourselves in that position, anybody listening. Laying awake at night wondering what's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to be harder for states to keep children and educators safe in schools, to try to provide assistance to keep small businesses alive. States and cities are already facing large budget shortfalls this year, again through no fault of their own. They've already laid off more than a million workers, even more teachers, firefighters, cops will lose their jobs unless federal government steps up now.
And that's President-elect Biden. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer have urged Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to use a $908 billion bipartisan coronavirus stimulus plan as a basis for relief talks as Congress scrambles to send aid to Americans before the end of the year. And Ramsey Orta, the man who filmed the police killing of Eric Garner, was slashed in the face earlier this month at a city jail. That's according to a notice of claim filed with the city. The Staten Island resident was attacked by an inmate while sleeping in his cell at the Vernon C. Bain Center in the Bronx. Orta has complained of constant harassment by cops and city officials since he recorded police officers using a chokehold against Eric Garner as he pleaded, "I can't breathe," in Staten Island. And New York State Attorney General Letitia James released police body camera and dashboard camera video of the deaths of Daniel Prude and Troy Hodge today. Prude, a 41-year-old black man from Chicago, died after an encounter with Rochester, New York police in March. News of Pride's killing came to light on September 2nd. An autopsy ruled his death a homicide from complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint. He had a small amount of PCP in his system at the time, explaining his erratic behavior. After police say Prude claimed to have COVID and was spitting at them, they placed a so-called spit bag over his head. The police video shows an officer grinding Pride's head into the pavement. A federal lawsuit from the Prude family against the city of Rochester alleges an internal cover-up. Seven officers involved in the encounter have been suspended with pay. Troy Hodge, 39, died during an altercation with Lockport police and members of the Niagara County Sheriff's Office in June 2019. Lockport is near Buffalo, New York. Police responded to a call from Hodge's mother that her son was acting erratically. Hodge was tased. After the encounter, he collapsed in medical distress and was declared dead shortly after.
Stop moving around.
No.
It's yours. It's yours.
What's that?
No, nothing. I'm just
moving around.
Getting all stuff together.
Oh, no.
Stop moving around.
I'm dead, man. I'm dead. You're not filming, man.
Those are tight. Just leave them.
Oh,
I'm
sorry.
We're safe.
I'm sorry.
What's that? Sounds like he was in the attic.
Where have we got to put him?
Drug treatment.
The New York State Attorney General serves as a special prosecutor when a police officer kills an unarmed civilian. The cases are investigated by the Special Investigations and Prosecutions Unit. James has directed camera footage obtained in investigations be released to the public. A grand jury is currently investigating the killing of Daniel Prude. And the United States House of Representatives endorsed the ending of the nation's decades-long drug war Friday. Under the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement, or MORE Act, cannabis would be removed from federal scheduling. It's currently Schedule 1, which means there's no medical use allowed, and possession, there's very little research or any other work with marijuana that's allowed by federal law. Prior convictions would be expunged under the new law, and it would be retroactive as well. The vote was 228 to 164 and marked the first time either chamber of Congress has voted to federally decriminalize cannabis, mostly but not entirely along party lines. Marijuana was legalized or decriminalized in five states last month, getting more votes in some red states than President Trump. Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee.
To summarize the provisions of the MORE Act, they fall into three categories. First, simply, it would remove marijuana or cannabis from the list or the schedule of federally controlled substances. This means that going forward, individuals could no longer be prosecuted federally for marijuana offenses. This does not mean that marijuana would now be legal in the entire United States, as some have tried to argue. It would simply remove the federal government from interfering with state laws and state structures from the business of prosecuting marijuana cases, and will leave the question of legality to the individual states. Those states choosing to decriminalize can do so without ongoing interference from the federal government. And those states that choose to continue to make marijuana illegal can continue to do so as well. Second, the bill would establish a taxation structure to collect a sales tax on marijuana, which over the course of 5 years could increase from 5% to 8%. The funds collected through this tax will be used to establish a trust to do good, to reinvest in communities ravaged by the war on drugs. I know it firsthand by living and growing up in those communities of color, and those communities beyond. What I would also say is it would bring banking a relief. Businesses who ultimately will come from this legislation legal will have the legal right and opportunity to secure legal banking relationships. The trust fund will be used for rehabilitation and reentry programs in the Department of Justice and for programs in the Small Business Administration to ensure that the growing marijuana market is diverse and opens up opportunities for entrepreneurship in communities that have been adversely impacted by the war on drugs. Finally, the bill would expunge and seal federal marijuana arrest and convictions and resentence offenders as appropriate a much-needed measure to try to undo the damage that has been done to our community since marijuana was arbitrarily placed on the list of controlled substances back in 1970. The numbers are staggering, but most of all, the numbers are staggering with the imbalance of prosecution of African Americans and people of Latinx heritage, Hispanic heritage. What an imbalance. What a massive infusion of incarceration across this nation. Thousands of men and women have suffered needlessly from the federal criminalization of marijuana, particularly in communities of color, and have borne the burden of collateral consequences for those ensnared in the criminal legal system that have damaged our society across generations. This is unacceptable, and we must change our laws. It is time for Congress to catch up with the reforms that states are enacted. It's time for Congress to catch up with Americans. 36 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam have adopted laws allowing legal access to cannabis. 15 states, the District of Columbia, and the Northern Mariana Islands have adopted laws for legalizing cannabis for adult recreational use. A total of 47 states have reformed their laws in one form or another pertaining to cannabis despite its federal criminalization. The state legal cannabis industry already employs almost 250,000 people, and the federal government needs to get out of the way of state-level decisions-making for their citizens. We need to open the door to research, better banking and tax laws. We need to help fuel economic growth in this industry. We need to save lives. We need to help young people. We need to bring our nation together. And we need to do this without continuing to spend federal resources on criminalization and unjust incarceration for marijuana offenses. We need to pass the MORE Act. That is why I support, and that is why I believe it is important for us to unify and support this bill today. And I ask my colleagues to do the same.
And that's Sheila Jackson Lee. Lee was joined by an unlikely member, GOP conservative Matt Gaetz, a strong Trump supporter who also spoke out for the bill with some reservations.
The MORE Act is flawed. It uses cannabis policy to do a great deal of social engineering to create new taxes and new programs and redistribution of assets. But I am here as the only Republican co-sponsor of the MORE Act, and I'm voting for it. Because the federal government has lied to the people of this country about marijuana for a generation. We have seen a generation, particularly of black and brown youth, locked up for offenses that should have not resulted in any incarceration whatsoever. I'm also deeply troubled that the current policy of the federal government inhibits research into cannabis, research that could unlock cures and help people live better lives. My Republican colleagues today will make a number of arguments against this bill, but those arguments are overwhelmingly losing with the American people. In every state where cannabis reform was on the ballot in this country, it passed. It passed with overwhelming support. Matter of fact, the only thing that I know that's more popular than getting out of the war on drugs is getting out of the war in Afghanistan. But if we were measuring the success in the war on drugs, it would be hard to conclude anything other than the fact that drugs have won, because the American people do not support the policies of incarceration, limited research, limited choice, and particularly constraining medical application. We are here in a time where many people in our country are suffering. They are in pain, and it is documented that that states with medical cannabis programs see a reduction in the prescribing of opioids and the number of opioid abuses and deaths. We've held hearings in the House Judiciary Committee where people in our government must confess that this is in fact true, that the more we give people access to medical cannabis programs, the more we see a blunting of this horrible scourge of opioid addiction and opioid abuse.
And that's Matt Gaetz, a strong Trump supporter, Republican conservative, who spoke out in support of the MORE Act to decriminalize marijuana at the federal level. Drug reform activists were thrilled by the win. The policy manager for national affairs of the Drug Policy Alliance is Queen Adesui.
This is a significant moment in drug policy reform history. The very body that was really responsible for institutionalizing the war on marijuana, a chamber of this body, has finally acknowledged that marijuana prohibition is failed policy, that ending marijuana criminalization on the federal level actually amounts to better public health, and a responsibility to account for the ways that marijuana criminalization has disproportionately impacted communities of color.
Not all of them voted against it, but most of them did. Saw the same arguments you hear, gateway drug, that it leads to heavy drug use, that children or teenagers will get a hold of it and it'll affect their developing brains. And then the new one that's been coming up, that somehow this causes problems with drugged driving, this new concept, drugged driving.
The criticisms of the GOP, for the most part, really centered in antiquated stigma and fear-mongering and false claims about the bill. And it's unfortunate because the GOP, for the most part, seems to be behind where the rest of the country seems to be going and is. For years, we've watched several states continue to relax their marijuana laws, and we've continued to see the conversation evolve to really expand beyond just what it means to end criminalization. The conversation has really, you know, bubbled up into the sphere of what racial justice means in the context of marijuana reform, what is owed to communities that had to bear the brunt of prohibition, and what is a accountable and ethical way of going about marijuana reform in acknowledgement of what's gone, of what's happened throughout the decades.
And there's a lot of disparity.
Marijuana should have never been criminalized to begin with. It's intellectually dishonest the way that marijuana has lived on the Controlled Substance Act at a Schedule One status, the way it's been over-enforced in communities of color, especially Black and Latinx communities. We've seen, on a national average, Black and Latinx people being arrested at four times the rate of white folks, despite similar rates of use. And that disparity has amounted to devastation in communities of color because of the thousands of collateral consequences that come with a conviction or previous arrest. It impacts people's ability to maintain viable employment, to access public benefits. It even threatens people's immigration status, which is an important part of the MORE Act. It addresses and accounts for collateral consequences related to immigration consequences for marijuana use. Even in legal states, people have faced immigration consequences for working in the legal industry.
You're saying that people, even in states where marijuana is legal, because they work in that legal industry, have had immigration problems. Why is that?
That's because of the discrepancy between state laws and federal laws. So because marijuana maintains its status as a federally controlled substance, people who are non-citizens are still at risk for deportation because immigration is handled on the federal level.
Has that happened?
Yes, it has happened. We've seen it throughout the states. There are plenty of examples in Denver and Colorado. That was an important part of this work. And that's why the Drug Policy Alliance convened the Marijuana Justice Coalition, because this is a coalition where we built array of organizations to really come to the table to address these issues in an intersectional way. One of our coalition partners is the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, and they've been really great allies in making sure that the bill does its best to protect non-citizens.
Where does this go next?
Unfortunately, this is something that's likely not going to be taken up by the Senate this Congress. This is not something that we're going to be seeing across the finish line through the president's desk this Congress, but it can't be understated how huge this victory is in the larger fight of ending the war on marijuana. We're hoping to see the next Congress, our abilities to reintroduce this bill and move it along in both chambers, and to make sure that we address some of the provisions that were included in the last minute that we don't approve of.
What were those?
The provision that was included that would allow for a felony exclusion on the federal level for people who are looking to get a permit, because the bill actually establishes a federal permit system. And we don't approve of exclusions based on a person's previous record. That is against the principles of the MORE Act, which is entirely around getting people who are formerly incarcerated and formerly impacted by the war on marijuana to be able to access the regulated market.
Queen Ada Sui is policy manager for national affairs of the Drug Policy Alliance. There are currently 2.3 million people in American jails. In 1970, at the start of the war on drugs, there were 200,000 prisoners. And a lawyer on President Donald Trump's election legal team, Sidney Powell, has been one of the loudest proponents of election fraud and vote rigging in the November election. One of her unfounded conspiracy theories is the Venezuelan government controls the voting machine company Dominion Voting Systems. At the same time, Powell and other Trump supporters have been clashing with mainstream Republicans by calling for a boycott of the Georgia runoff, the vote holding the key to the control of the Senate. But Georgia is not the only election facing a boycott. On Sunday, the political party party supporting Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido will be sitting out the South American nation's National Assembly elections. He's arguing President Nicolas Maduro rigged the 2018 presidential election that Guaido lost. And while the United Nations and European Union say they won't be sending election observers to Venezuela, the peace group Code Pink will. The group's Latin American campaign coordinator is Leonardo Flores.
Venezuela has National Assembly elections every 5 years, and constitutionally they have to hold elections this year. There are 14,000 candidates running from over 100 political parties. Over 90 of those are in opposition to the government of Nicolas Maduro, and people are going to elect 277 members of the National Assembly.
Is this a democratic election?
Absolutely. So Venezuela's elections are one of the safest in the world. It's an electronic voting system backed by paper receipts. So when voters use the voting machine, it's all digital, of course, but after their vote is cast, the machine prints out a paper receipt that the voter can then use to verify that the vote cast is what they intended. They then place that receipt in a secure ballot box. At the end of the voting day, there's a digital tally, and afterwards that digital tally is audited by the counting of 54% of those ballot boxes and matching them to their respective voting machines. That 54% number is much higher than necessary for a statistically significant result. So these are, very safe and trustworthy. It's a very safe and trustworthy system.
How come the United States is constantly saying it's undemocratic?
Well, the United States has been trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government for about 20 years now. This strategy of saying that the elections are undemocratic is actually nothing new. In the run-up to the previous National Assembly elections, 2015, when Hillary Clinton was at the State Department said in the run-up to the elections that they were going to be fraudulent. What happened on that occasion was the opposition took a majority of the seats, and then the State Department changed the tune and they accepted the results because the opposition won. So really, it's a case of the U.S. government, pushing for one side to win, and to do that, they have to discredit the elections unless their side wins. So they only recognize elections when it's the opposition that wins and not when Chavismo, the socialist movement behind President Maduro, wins.
Do you know if they have any COVID, like we had in the United States, a mail-in absentee ballots, anything like that?
No, all the voting is in person, but Venezuela has done very well in terms of COVID. And so, for example, masks will be required, as social distancing will be required. There's antibacterial gel at all the stations. And it should be noted that Venezuela has less than 1,000 total COVID deaths throughout this whole experience, mostly because the country has been kind of in a radical lockdown for the past 6 months, where they have a week of total lockdown and then a week of a partial lockdown where certain businesses are open at certain times. And that's really managed to keep the pandemic under control.
Now, is the opposition represented in this election? Are they running?
The opposition is split. The opposition in general is kind of a wide, big tent coalition that really has a lot of kind of ideological variance in it. But most recently, they've split because there's a sector of the moderate opposition that wants to participate in elections that doesn't think boycotting is a good idea. And beyond that, this sector of the opposition also is against the sanctions, against the attempted coups, and against the threats of military invasion. Juan Guaido, who's the leader of what we call the extremist opposition, him and his faction have decided to boycott the elections, in part because of pressure from the United States. But there's another broad sector of the opposition that is participating fully in these elections. And the hope is that they'll encourage enough turnout to give more legitimacy to these elections.
So the United States is advocating the boycott of a democratic election. Sounds like Georgia.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of comparisons in the United States here in terms of you had President Trump saying that there was fraud in the most recent elections here in the U.S. without offering any proof. And the same is happening again. The U.S. is saying there will be fraud in Venezuela. There's no proof of that. There's no proof that there was fraud in the 2018 presidential elections, where you had a similar dynamic of a partial opposition boycott and the U.S. kind of denouncing and rejecting those elections months before they were even held.
What day is the election and what's your expectation?
So elections are held on Sunday, December 6th. My expectation...
They're held on a day off.
Correct. They're held on a day off so that everyone can vote. Everything is closed on that Sunday. And also, I would say something like 97%, or if not higher, of eligible voters are registered to vote. So we don't have these sort of systemic issues in terms of shutting voters out than we have here in the United States. Right. And what I expect really is a day of people voting calmly and in peace. It's hard to say what the turnout will be. I think that will be a very important figure to look out. But also because of this partial opposition boycott, it's expected that President Maduro's party is going to win back the National Assembly. It's not clear what the margins will be yet, though.
He doesn't hold it right now. He lost it.
Correct. He lost it in 2015 using the exact same system, electoral system, that's going to be in place on Sunday.
So it goes back and forth like it does anywhere else.
It does. It has, yes.
Flores is Latin American campaign coordinator for Code Pink. And that's some of the news for Friday, December 4th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.